Osho, Tao, the Pathless Path, Volume 2. Talks and extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 2.
The first question. It seemed to me that Gramya's question on Tuesday was practically the same as mine on Sunday, only worded differently. But you answered her very lovingly and gently, and me with a 1000 lb sledgehammer. Bhagwan, excuse me for asking this, but I too mean to ask lovingly. Why have you become so hard on old disciples? And Bhagwan, don't you love me anymore? I am with you, whatever is the case. The question is from Ananda Prem. The first thing, Ananda Prem, you cannot ask a question that Gramya can ask. Nobody else can ask the question that you can ask. Even if you use exactly the same words, the question will be different, and you will get a different answer from me. I am not answering the question, I am answering the questioner. And that is to be understood. You can write a question exactly the same as Gramya, and I will not answer it the same way. You are not Gramya. Gramya is not you. Everybody is so unique. Everybody is so individual. Never before there has been anybody like you. Never will be there ever anybody like you. You are simply you. Only one you. There is nobody else like you. So how somebody else can ask a question like you? How you can ask a question like somebody else? The question, the wording, the language, the formulation is not important at all. It arises out of your consciousness, out of your mind. And you have a different mind and a different consciousness, a different character, a different past. It arises out of your past. So never compare with others' questions. When I answer you, I answer you. That's why I insist you should write your names on the questions. Otherwise the question becomes general. Then the answer is in the abstract. Then it is not addressed to anybody. And the answer, to be meaningful, has to be particular. It has to be addressed to a particular individual in a specific way. Only then it applies to you, otherwise not. It seemed to me that Gramya's question was practically the same as mine on Sunday. No. Neither practically the same nor theoretically the same. Only worded differently. Don't try to deceive yourself. It was worded differently, true, but even if it was not worded differently, my answer would have been the same. Even when we use the same words, we don't mean the same thing. The meaning is not in the words. The meaning is in the mind that uses them. Meditate on this small anecdote. The businessman was told by his doctor that he had a heart condition. On the same day, he was advised by a maid that if he didn't meet a heavy mortgage payment, his home would be seized. Driving nervously down the highway in a new car on which 5 payments were due, he ran into the compact car of his best customer and made a sardine can out of it. Continuing to his office, he arrived at the factory just as the firemen were watering down the hot embers. There his bookkeeper handed him a note informing that all his insurance policies had lapsed. Disgusted, he took a cab home, walked slowly into the living room, and was greeted cheerfully by his wife. "Darling," she said enthusiastically, "I hope you will forgive me, but I must run. Tonight is my bridge night." "Just give a chance to change myself," answered her husband, "and I will jump with you." The bridge night. But how it can mean the same thing to the husband? In that state, it cannot mean the same. You speak same words, but still you convey different meanings. The meaning is given by the mind. The word is the outside thing. The meaning is the inside thing. Because of the fog, the plane was in a serious trouble. All the passengers were numb with fear, except the minister Abosh. He took complete control of the situation. "Let us kneel and pray," he suggested to the passengers, and everyone knelt except a small time bookie. "Why are not you praying with us?" asked the minister. "Because," confessed the bookie, "I don't know how." "In that case," the minister advised, "just behave as though you were in a church." So the bookie went down the aisle and took up a collection. That is the only thing the bookie can understand. That is the only thing he will become interested in, a church. Remember always, it is you who comes loud and clear into your questions. I am not much interested how they are worded, how they are formulated. I seek for you. I grope for you in your question. And unless I have got a hold of you, I don't answer, because then it is meaningless. Don't feel jealous of Gramya. It seems Anand Prem has become jealous of Gramya. That again shows her mind. Rather than understanding what I have said to her, she is more worried why I have answered Gramya so lovingly and not her question so lovingly. She was less interested in the answer. She was more interested in love being sought to her. That again shows her mind. So the question was not for the answer. Then the question was just a trick so that I can show my love to you. Then why go so roundabout? Why not simply write, "Bhagwan, say some beautiful things about me"? That would be easy, simple. Why make such big questions? then be direct that I need to be appreciated, applauded. But the mind is tricky. You may ask something and you may not be at all interested in the question or in the answer. There may be some secret desire lurking behind it. Seeing that desire, I had to use the 1000 lb sledgehammer. But you missed. You ducked. You should have bowed down before that 1000 lb hammer. You should have received it, accepted it, welcomed it. And it would have given you tremendous insight. But you missed. Rather than listening to what I have said to you, you have listened more to what I have said to Gramya. And now you feel jealous. Why I have not said the same thing to you? It was not your need. When you come to me, I have to give you the medicine that you need. You cannot say why you have given to Gramya a very sweet medicine and to me a very bitter thing. But you need that. The sweet medicine may kill you. It is not your need. I am a physician. I am trying to help you come out of your diseases. You may not be too much interested in coming out of your diseases, but that is my only interest. I am not interested in anything else. You may be simply hankering for sympathy. Sympathy is poison. Has to be used only when poison is needed. Sometimes, a ill person needs poison too. The whole allopathy depends on poison. But you should not ask the doctor what medicine should be given to you. You should not prescribe yourself. Now this is not only you have come with a disease, you have come with a prescription also. You want me to sign on it. So you will be very happy. If you can doctor yourself, then my need is not there. Then doctor yourself. If you cannot doctor yourself, then listen to what I say. Meditate over it. All the nuances of it. All the meanings settle and grasp in it. You should have meditated that a hammer would have helped you tremendously. 1000 lb sledgehammer had to be used because, Anand Prem, you have a very thick head. It is almost a rock. In fact, when I use the hammer, I am always worried whether the hammer is going to survive or not. And you ask, why have you become so hard on old disciples? That's why. That's what the old disciple is for. You have graduated, Anand Prem. Gramya will also graduate weight. The older you are, the harder I will be. Because I hope you must have become more capable. I hope now you will be able to receive greater socks. When a new disciple comes, naturally, I cannot hit him very hard. I have to be very cautious. I go slowly. More and more the disciple comes closer to me, more and more I become certain now the moment is and the disciple can be hit hard. Because deep down the whole function of a master is to behead you. The master is a soul. Says Jesus, I have not brought peace into the world, I have brought a soul. Buddhists have given a special name for it. They call it Manjushri's soul. Manjushri is a great disciple of Buddha. And Manjushri functions as Buddha's soul. Whenever Buddha will see that somebody needs the real shock, he will be sent to Manjushri. Manjushri was really terrible. He will simply smash you. He will not allow any illusions. He was so hard in hitting that the moment Buddha will prescribe, go to Manjushri, and people will start trembling. Manjushri? That means almost death. But Manjushri was really a great compassionate Buddha himself. It became famous in Buddha's time that whenever a disciple has really grown, Buddha sends him to Manjushri, the butcher. When you are old, I hope that you will be capable of much more understanding. The day you are really old and you have come very close to me, then I am going to cut your head. And that has to be done so suddenly, so fast, that not even a drop of blood comes out. That has to be done so fast. But for that you have to become by and by more and more prepared. The work of the master is not to console you. If you have come for consolations here, you have come in a wrong company. Go somewhere else. If you have come only for transformation, then be here. Otherwise, I am not the person for you. I know your secret desires are not of transformation. Your secret desire is of improvement. And improvement and transformation are just diametrically opposite. Improvement means you remain the same, you become more and more rich. Your ego becomes more and more decorated. You remain the same. Whatever happens becomes a new layer on you, but you remain the same. The new is an addition to you, but you remain continuous with the old. You are for improvement. You want to become beautiful. You want to become more blissful. You want to become more knowledgeable. You want to become a Buddha, this and that. The Buddha disease. I am not here to improve upon you. Because if the base remains wrong, all improvement is going to lead you into more and more troubles. The base has to be transformed. From the roots you have to be cut. Naturally, it is going to be hard, arduous. Just the other day I was telling you about the Hebrew name Miriam, Jesus' mother's name. It means rebellion. It has another meaning also. And both the meanings are beautiful. One is rebellion, another is arduous, harsh. The path is a razor's edge. It is hard and arduous. Jesus comes through that arduous path, Maryam. Rebellion and arduous. And the greatest difficulty to be encountered is the ego. Now, Anand Prem asked the question, and she must have been listening with the idea that I will decorate her ego a little bit here and there, will give her new enthusiasm. And I took away the very ground underneath her feet that shocked her. But the older you are around me, wait for many more shocks. That's the only way I can show my love to you. You ask, and Bhagwan, don't you love me anymore? Now I have started loving you, Anand Prem. Hence the 1000 lb sledgehammer. When I will love you more, I will have to take even weightier hammers. Otherwise, why should I bother to hit you at all? For what profit? By hitting you, only two possibilities are. Either you receive it and you become more understanding, or you escape from me. What I am going to gain out of it? Either you are going to gain, or I am going to miss you. There is no gain for me in it all. Two are the alternatives. Either you escape from me, become very much afraid, then I have lost the disciples. Or you become enlightened, then too I have lost the disciples. So what is the gain? For me at least, there is no gain. I am going to be a loser either way. And finally she says, in a bracket, I am with you whatever is the case. That I know. That I know. I know your stubbornness. During a flood in a little town, a little girl was perched on top of a house with a small boy. As they sat watching, they noticed a derby hat float by. Presently, the hat turned and came back. Then again turned and went down a sea. Once more it turned and came back. The little girl said, "What do you think of that derby? First it goes downstream, then it turns and comes back." The boy replied, "Ah, that is my father. He says, come hell or high water, I am going to cut the grass today." And I know Anand Prem is that type. She is absolutely stubborn. That much I can trust, she will not leave. So only one possibility is left. If she becomes capable of receiving the shocks that I am going to give, this was just the beginning, then there is a possibility of a new light dawning in her soul. The second question, What do you mean when you say to ponder or meditate upon a parable? What is the process? P.S. I can hardly even remember the parable after the discourse. That means the discourse has succeeded. I don't mean to memorize it. If you have understood it, the fragrance enters into your soul. It is not a question of memorizing. This is not a university. And nobody is going to examine your memory. Nobody is going to ask how much you remember. When I say ponder over it, I don't mean repeat it, remember it, cram it. No. When I say ponder over it, I mean let the fragrance of it be released into your soul. There are three steps. Buddha has said how to listen to a Buddha. Three steps. First, hearing. Second, pondering. Third, living. Hearing means when you are listening to me, you should simply listen, not think about it. Do not go on commenting inside your mind, right, wrong, good, bad. No commentary on your part is needed. All commentary will be a distraction. And you will miss. When I say listen, I don't mean concentrate. Because if you concentrate, you will become very tense. In a tense mind, meditation is not possible. So when I say listen, hear, the first step, it means simply be relaxed, open, available. I'm singing a song to you. Let this song reach and vibrate in you. You should not be worried whether you will be able to remember it or not. That is not the point at all. Once you have vibrated with it, something of it would have penetrated in your being, will become part of you. In fact, that is real knowledge which becomes part of you and you need not cram it. The unreal knowledge is that which you have crammed and has not become a part of you. A student goes to the examination and he remembers 1001 things, and after 3 months you ask him, 99% of it is gone, down the drain. It was just somehow managed with very great tension and strain. He was keeping it, holding it for the examination. Once the examination is finished, he will lose that hold and things will disappear. Can't you observe it in your own life? How much you remember that which you had crammed in your university days? How much? If you are examined again, you will all fail. You will not be able to remember. Even the professors who teach in the university will all fail if they are examined again. Because that was just a momentary effort. But real knowledge is never forgotten. Because real knowledge is never remembered. That which is remembered will be forgotten. That which is not remembered cannot be forgotten. There is no way to forget it. There are few things you can never forget. For example, swimming. You cannot forget it. You may not have been to the river for 50 years. but you cannot forget it, because it has never been remembered. It has went, it has gone into your being, it has become part of you. This is real knowledge. All that is real becomes part of you. It remains available forever and ever. There is no way to forget it. I call that knowledge which cannot be forgotten. Even if you make effort, you will fail. You cannot forget it. Watch in life. You will find two categories, different categories. One, that you have to remember, but you go on forgetting again and again. Another, that you don't remember, but it's simply there. Is there, not as a memory, but has become part of your being. There is no need to hold it. It is simply there. Even if you want to throw it, you cannot throw it. That is real knowledge. So when I say here, I am not saying be attentive. Because in attention there is tension. And the very word is out of tension. Attention means at tension. Your mind is narrowed. When I say listen, hear, I mean be relaxed, open. Become a sponge. Soak. Let it sink in you. You listen to me as you listen to the birds singing in the trees. Or the sound of running water. There is no meaning in it. Or music. Music has no intellectual meaning. You listen to it. You simply drink it. You let it in. You allow it into your very innermost core. And you enjoy it. If somebody asked later on, do you remember what music you had heard? You will not be able to say anything. You will say, I enjoyed it. It was beautiful. It was something that thrilled me to the very core. I was refreshed through it. I became more alive through it. I felt a sudden joy bursting in my heart. But these are the impacts that happen to you. This is nothing to say about music. Listen to me as music. So don't be worried if you forget good. I'm not saying these things to be remembered. I'm not here to make you knowledgeable professional pundits. No. I'm not here giving you a training for memory. But an upsurge of understanding can happen. You can respond. Whatever I am saying, you can respond to it. You can vibrate with it. And that will be real hearing. That is the first step. Second step is pondering. First step, hearing, is through the mind doors. Because you have to use the ears and you have to use the mechanical device of the mind. It goes through the mind. If you are not thinking, the mind allows it. If the mind is thinking, the mind obstructs, distorts, and does many things to it. If the mind is not thinking, the mind becomes simply a pure passage, a receptivity. Hearing is through mind, pondering is through heart. When the mind has allowed it, all that you listen in silence, in love, and wrapped with my being, falls into your heart, accumulates there. Remember the difference. If you want to remember it, it will be written in the head. The memory exists in the head. If you don't want to retain it, you are not interested in remembering it, then it goes into the heart. It falls, pours into the heart, accumulates there. But then it has a total different impact on your being. You will not remember it, but it will surround you like a fragrance. Ponder it. When I say, I mean, let it reach to your heart. Don't listen through thinking, listen through feeling. That is the meaning of pondering. Ponder over it means let your feeling be aroused. Not your thought, not your logic, but your love. Let your love respond. That's the difference. When an outsider comes and listens to me, just as an outsider, at the most he will be able to accumulate something in the head when you become a sannyasin. It changes. It changes completely. Then you listen in a totally different way. Then you are not fighting with me. You are not arguing with me. Then you are simply enjoying the song. You dance with me, you sing with me, you be with me. Then it reaches in the heart. You feel with me. Whatever I say to you has nothing to do with my head. It comes from the heart. I say it because I feel for you. I say it because I love you. I say it because great compassion is there. I say it because I want to share my heart with you. It is not a lecture. I'm not lecturing at you. I'm not your enemy. Why should I lecture at you? I'm simply opening my heart. I'm allowing you to come in me. I am inviting you to become my guest. I am inviting you to partake something of my being. That's what Jesus means when he says to his disciples, eat me, drink me. This is a feast. When I say ponder, I also mean eat me, drink me. Feel me. Let your feeling be thrilled, stirred. Let your heart dance. Rejoice with me. It is a great tiding. I bring you a gospel. And the third is living. First hear. Thought not interfering, then feel, fall and repulse with me, in tune with me, and then live it. It is not a question of cramming, remembering, living. Yes, living is the thing. You hear me. If it goes into your heart, it will become very easy to live it. Because from the heart, where else it can go? It will go into your being. These are the three layers. First layer, thinking, the head. Deeper than the head is the heart, feeling. And deeper than the heart is being. So if it soaks through the head, it reaches to the heart. If it soaks through the heart, it reaches to your being. And from there comes living. I am not saying practice it. Practice happens only when something has not reached your heart. Has been written by the head and then you try to practice it. Practice means you are avoiding the heart. keeping in the head, and now you think what to do about it, how to manage, how to practice, how to create a character on the base of it. If it reaches your heart, then you can relax. It will by and by start affecting your living. So what has to be done on the third point? Only you have not to force it, and you have not to obstruct it when it comes. Don't stand in the way. To many people it is happening every day. Something I had said you 6 months before, you have completely forgotten. Then a situation arises in life and suddenly it is there. And it starts functioning. You behave accordingly. Not that you try. If you try, that is not the real thing. That is pseudo. But suddenly one day you feel you are not behaving in the old pattern. The gestalt has changed. Somebody insults you and you don't feel hurt. You are surprised yourself. What has happened? Now, if this happens, allow it to happen. Support it. Cooperate with it. It is very new and fragile. It will need your support. Sometimes it happens. It is happening, but you obstruct it because you think this man is insulting you. This is no time to ponder upon great things. And if I allow him to insult, he will insult me more. Today he will insult, tomorrow he will start beating me. Then your mind starts bringing the old pattern. Your heart is saying, relax, this is the moment, smile. All those beautiful parables and all that fragrance that you have been accumulating in your heart is ready to explode. But your mind says, wait, this is not the moment to meditate. And this is not the moment to think about great things. This is dangerous. And you shrink. If you shrink, then that which was happening naturally has been obstructed. So all that you can do is negative. Don't obstruct. Now, hearing, don't think. That is negative. Let it be there. Pondering on the heart is positive. Feel. Again, living is negative. Don't obstruct. Let it take its own form and shape. Let it flow wherever it goes. Don't be worried. Don't start manipulating the energy. Allow it. Be in a let go. Hearing is negative. Pondering is positive. Living is again negative. And then you will come to know the ultimate positive, the fourth step. What in India we have called Turi, the fourth. That is your selfless self. Beingless being. Being as non-being. What Buddha calls anatta. No selfness. That is the most positive thing. That will happen. Negative hearing, positive pondering, negative living, and then happens the ultimate positive, the ultimate being. But the most basic problem arises in the first step. The first step is always the most basic. The second follows easily, the third even more easily, the fourth without any problem comes on its own accord. But the first is the most difficult step. Have you not watched a small child starting to walk? The first step is the most difficult step. The child hesitates. He has never walked. The child has no self-confidence. The child cannot trust that he will be able to walk. How can you trust the unknown that you have never done before? Again and again, the child starts crawling, afraid. He may fall. He may hurt himself. The first step is the most difficult step. Once he has taken the first step, then it is very difficult to prevent him not to take the first, not to take the second. It is impossible to prevent him. Whenever the mother is not looking, he will try again. He may fall, but now he has known the adventure, the beauty of it, that he can stand on his own. So the first step, listening without thinking. When I am talking, there is every possibility you are continuously thinking how to practice it. That is your greed. Beware of it. The greed will not allow you to hear. Two millionaires were discussing their personal buying habits. I like to shop at Lord and Taylor's. They are very reliable, said the first. My coat on a nail in front of the store. I tore my coat on a nail in front of the store and they immediately gave me $10. Really? Guess the second, do you think the nail is still there? Now this man cannot listen. He has already moved into greed. Do you think the nail is still there? He appears only to listen, but he has gone into the future. He has started planning what to do, how to get those $10. And he may be a millionaire. That doesn't matter. When you listen to me, don't start trips in your mind. It happens every day. I can even feel when a person has gone on a trip. His face changes. He is no more here. A certain lust can be seen on his face. Greed. He has started thinking what to do about it, how to do it, and how beautiful it will be if I can do it. Listening, just listen. Don't move from here. One way is to move into the future. Don't do that. Another way is to move into the past. Don't do that either. When you listen to me, you start thinking, yes, I have heard this. I have read about this. That's what I also think. But then you have stopped listening. It was one of the greatest manhunts of all time, and Detective O'Sullivan was hot on the trail of the killer. He trailed him into a department store, then he trailed him into a restaurant, then he trailed him into a trailer, but he lost him eventually. How in God's name did you lose him? The chief roared angrily. I followed him into every hole in town, explained the great O'Sullivan, ace of the force, into everything from men's toiletries to men's toilets. But I didn't follow him when he went into the movies. That's where I lost him. And why didn't you follow him into the movies? The chief calmly queried, bursting a blood vessel. Because I already saw the picture. Remember, don't bring the pictures that you have seen before. Don't bring your memories in. When I am taking you into something, just relax and go with me. Don't allow the future to interfere. Don't allow the past to interfere. When the past and future are not interfering, you are hearing. When you are hearing, the second step is very easy. Your heart will gather the fragrance of whatsoever is being poured into you, has been told to you. Your heart will start throbbing with a new rhythm that you had not known before, with new energy, with new vitality. The heart will start a new movement of energy. Then enjoy that. Don't be afraid of it, because you are very afraid of the heart. You have been taught to control the heart. You have been taught to reduce the heart to be a slave and make the head a master. You will have to do just the opposite if you really want to go with me into the unknown. The head has not to be the master anymore. Instead of the head, the heart has to be crowned again. The heart has to become the emperor again. The heart is the master. Feeling should be the master, not thinking. Because joy is a feeling, not a thought. Because love is a feeling, not a thought. Because happiness is a feeling, not a thought. Because silence is a feeling, not a thought. Because God is a feeling, not a thought. Let feeling be the supreme most, the sovereign. And let the head serve it. This turn, this conversion makes one religious. And then the third is even more easier. Then only don't obstruct. When your heart starts functioning in your day-to-day life, allow it, go with it. Take the risk. That's what I mean when I say meditate over this parable. The fourth question. I am terribly scared to ask this question. Why do you mention Swami Yog Chinmaya's name when he asks a question? And why does something in me have to ask this question? It is from Deva Nirvesh. First, Swami Yog Chinmaya's name makes you laugh. And it saves me a joke. That is economical. Second, it makes you happy. It makes Swami Chinmaya happy. It makes me happy. You laugh, you are happy. Chinmaya is happy, his name has been mentioned. I am happy because you all are happy. So at no cost, everybody is simply happy. That's why. And it is a tacit understanding now that when Swami Yog Chinmaya asks a question, it is bound to be ridiculous. So just mentioning the name is enough. He is a great seeker. And when you are a great seeker, you stumble upon many ridiculous questions. He goes on thinking about everything. When you go on thinking about everything, you are bound to find out many ridiculous questions. In fact, deep down, every question is ridiculous. Life simply is. It is not a question. And there is no answer for it. It simply is. There is no question mark on life. If you look deeply, you will find there is an exclamation mark, but no question mark. Life is a wonder, a mystery. But that happens only when you look at life as a poet. Chinmaya looks at life as a thinker. Then the exclamation mark appears like a question mark. That is the mistake every thinker is bound to commit. And he is a very logical thinker. He thinks logically, but logic always leads into absurdities of what he can do. He goes to the very end. And then the thing turns into a ridiculous question. And he is courageous to ask. So it is a tacit understanding. When I mention the name of Swami Yog Chinmaya, you can relax. You know that something beautiful is coming. I have heard it happen in a madhouse. A new superintendent had come to take charge. The old superintendent introduced him to the inmates. A great meeting was called of all the mad people. There were many. And the new superintendent was simply surprised. He could not believe what is happening. Because the old superintendent simply said few numbers. He said 49, and everybody started laughing. And they laughed so uproariously. They were busting. They started rolling. And then he said 72, and they started going mad. And the new superintendent could not understand what is happening. So when the speech was finished, it was just numbers. He asked, "What is the matter? What are these numbers?" And the old superintendent said that I have been here for many years and they are here for many years. So we have a tacit understanding. I have numbered my jokes. What is the point of saying the same joke again and again and again? 49, and they know. So they laugh. It is the arrangement. 72 is the most ridiculous. That's why they were jumping and they were rolling on the floor. Everybody knows. The new superintendent said, "This is beautiful. I will try tomorrow." So he listened few jokes, remembered the numbers, and next day he stood there and said 49, but nobody laughed. What happened? So thinking that maybe they are not in such a jovial mood today, he said 72. But they sat there, nobody even smiled. He looked at the old superintendent. "What is the matter?" The old man said, "You don't know how to tell a joke." So please remember, if you say Swami Yog Chinmaya, nobody will laugh. It is a number, a tacit understanding, and one has to know how to say it. The woman sought the hallowed advice of the marriage counselor. "I just don't know what to do." She was obviously distressed. "The first year my husband spoke to me only once, and we had a son. The second year he spoke twice and we had twins. The third year he spoke to me thrice and we had triplets. The fourth year four times and we had quadruplets. What shall I do? Tell him to just point. You will know what he means. It is a tacit understanding by now that if I say Swami Yogacinema, it is enough. You can trust me. You ask, I am terribly scared to ask this question. You should not be scared. Why you should be scared? This is such a beautiful question. Nirvesh, if you go on asking such questions, I need a Ma too. Swami Yogacinema is one, Ma Deva Nirvesh can become second. Just go on, persist, persevere. You should not be scared. And I have heard the rumors that Nirvesh is moving with Swami Yogacinema. It is a rumor. I cannot vouch for it. And rumors go here, move fast. So many women, you know. Women may not have the sense of humor, but they have the sense of rumor. And you ask, and why does something in me have to ask this question? Now that you have to ask to yourself. You must be feeling sympathetic to Swami Yogacinema. Beware. Because only wrong people feel sympathetic to Yogacinema. Beware. He had up to now only one great follower, Ma Ananda Prem. Now you may be... The fifth question, why don't I have any other questions than this one? I am not enlightened, so I feel my mind is becoming dull. It is just the other way round. Your mind is dull, that's why you are not becoming enlightened. Now you are putting things completely in a wrong sequence. Don't wait for enlightenment to come, and don't hope that when enlightenment comes, then you will become intelligent. It will never come. Intelligence is the first requirement for it to happen at all. Intelligence is the preparation for it. Be intelligent. Behave intelligently. Live intelligently. Otherwise, enlightenment is not going to happen at all. If you are just hoping that one day enlightenment will come and then you will be intelligent, a genius, you are wrong. There are few people who go on talking nonsense things like this. One of them is old Pandit Gopi Krishna. He thinks that when Kundalini arises, one becomes a genius. One becomes tremendously intelligent. This is not true. If you are tremendously intelligent, only your Kundalini arises, otherwise not. If Gopi Krishna is right, it means a dull-headed, a stupid person can make his Kundalini rise and can become intelligent. That is impossible. To help your energy to rise and soar high, you will need tremendous intelligence, sharp intelligence. Otherwise, you will not be able to bring your energy so high. A stupid person cannot do that. Enlightenment, nirvana, moksha, liberation, whatsoever your name, are the arousal of the kundalini energy. These are just names, symbolic. One thing is certain, intelligence has to precede them. You cannot afford to be stupid and hope that someday something will happen and you will become enlightened. Then you are hoping in vain. You will have to create intelligence. How to create intelligence? First, become more and more alert in small things. Walking on the road, become more alert. Try to be more alert. Now, such a simple process, walking on the road, you need not have any alertness. You can remain stupid and walk well. That's what everyone is doing. The stupidness does not hinder you at all. Start from small things. Taking your bath, be alert. Standing under the shower, become very alert. That cold water falling on you, the body enjoying it, you become alert. You become conscious of what is happening. Relaxed, yet conscious. And this moment of consciousness has to be brought again and again in 1001 ways. Eating, talking, meeting a friend, listening to me, meditating, making love. In all situations, try to become more and more alert. Hard it is. Certainly difficult it is, but not impossible. Slowly, slowly, the dust will disappear and your mirror-like consciousness will reveal itself. You will become more intelligent. And then live intelligently. You live in such a confused way, in such a stupid way, that if you see somebody else living that way, you will immediately say he is stupid. But you are doing the same. But somehow, one manages not to look at one's life. Now a man comes to me and says, what to do, Bhagwan? I have fallen in love with two women. Now one is enough. One will do enough harm. He has fallen in love with two women. Now both hearts are struggling. And he is crushed. And he says, I'm in misery. Both are fighting over me. And naturally, from both the sides, he is being hit. And if I say to him, choose one, he says, this is difficult. That means one person is riding on two horses, and he says, it is difficult to choose one. Then let it have it your own way. Then you will destroy your life. Choosing two women or two men as your love object is bound to split you. You will become a schizophrenic. And you will start falling apart. Now this is stupid. It is so simple to look into the phenomenon. Maybe sometimes it is difficult. It is difficult. But then too one has to choose. You cannot go in all the directions simultaneously. If you have come to listen to me, you have chosen. You have missed few things. You could have been in a restaurant, sitting with friends, sipping coffee. That you have chosen not to do that. You may have gone to a movie. You have chosen not to go there. Or you may have chosen just to lie down in your bed and relax and be a Taoist. That you have not chosen. You have come to listen to me and to sit on this hard marble floor, cold and hurting. But you have chosen. What you will say about a man who just stands outside his house and says, I am in a difficulty. I cannot go to the lecture. I cannot go to the bed because I want to do both together. So I am standing here. He will miss both. If you look into your life, you will find how unintelligently you have been behaving. You read a book and you accumulate knowledge and you start thinking that you have known. You have learned the word God and you think you know God. You are ready to argue. Not only to argue, you are ready to kill and be killed. How many Mormons, how many Hindus, how many Christians have been killed for something they have read only in a book? Tremendously stupid people. One is fighting for the Quran, another is fighting for Gita, another is fighting for Bible. For books you are fighting and killing living people and sacrificing your tremendously valuable life. What are you doing? But man has behaved in stupid ways. Because everybody else is behaving in the same way does not make it intelligent. If all are fools, that does not make you intelligent because you are following others. I have heard, a flock of birds were flying in the sky, and one bird asked another, why we always follow this stupid leader? And the other said, I don't know, I have heard that only he has the map. The map. Nobody has the map. But you go on following the Pope and the Shankaracharya and the Maulvi and the Pandit and you think they have the map, they know. Just look into their lives, what they know. They may be even far more stupid than you are. Just look the unintelligent way they are living. Watch their life. Are they happy? Is there a dance in their life? Is there fragrance in their life? Just looking at them, do you feel a silence hovering on you? Nothing of the sort. Then just because they have a book and they have read the book for years, studied it, does not make any sense. Become a man of knowing, not a man of knowledge, then you live intelligently. And to me, intelligence is the basic morality, the basic virtue. If you are intelligent, you will not harm anybody because that is foolish. If you are intelligent, you will not harm yourself because that is foolish. The life is so precious. It is not to be wasted. It has to be lived in deep celebration, in deep gratitude. And one has to be very careful and watchful because the moment gone is gone forever. It will never return. So if you waste it in the stupidity, you are wasting a great opportunity. Live each moment so totally, so fully aware that you never repent back later on, that you couldn't live, you could have lived more, you could have enjoyed more. That's what intelligence is, to live life so totally that there is no repentance, never. One is always contented. One knows that one has lived to one's uttermost. Then, in that uttermost state of awareness, enlightenment happens. You say, I am not enlightened, so I feel my mind is becoming dull. No, sir. Your mind is dull. That's why you are not becoming enlightened. So don't wait for enlightenment to come and do everything for you. Do something so your dullness is dropped. And it can be dropped because nobody is born dull. Every child is born intelligent. Can't you see in children how intelligent they are? How full of life. How full of love. How full of joy. Look into their eyes, how much shine in the eyes. They are the glories of God. Then the society jumps over them, and the parents and the teachers and the education system, and everybody starts making them dull. Because the society needs dull people. Only dull people can be dominated, oppressed. Only dull people can be ordered to go here and there and to do this and that. Only dull people are needed by the society, because dull people are very efficient. They don't have any mind. They are not dangerous. Dull people are very convenient. Dull people drag their life, their whole life. Just think of people who are intelligent. Do you think anybody will be ready to waste his whole life as a clerk? Just think of it. Anybody will be ready just to waste his whole life as a politician? Anybody would be ready just to waste his whole life as a soldier? For what? One would like to live an intelligent life of love, art, creativity, many things from the world will disappear if people were intelligent. Almost 90% things will simply disappear. The war will not be possible. Now, almost war is the major work of humanity on the earth. For centuries, 70% of money is wasted in war. 70%. So what you are doing? Simply preparing for war. You don't know anything else. You know only how to kill. People have become efficient only for killing. This can be done only by dull people. Intelligent people will throw the arms. They will dump all the atom bombs in the Pacific. And they will say goodbye for all war. For what? Life is so short. And so much is there to enjoy. The stars and the moon and the flowers and the man and the women and the rivers and the mountains. And you are simply fighting. And just living a very dull and stupid life. Society needs dull people, remember it. So beware that the society will not like you to become intelligent. It will like you to become a machine. Efficient, certainly, but not intelligent. Do the work that is given to you and die. Drag your life from the office to the house, from the house to the office. The whole life from the office to the house, from the house to the office. In the house you will have a wife to nag you, and in the office you will have a boss to insult and humiliate you, and on the road the mad traffic. Go to the office, back home, to the office, again home, and then one day you die. That is the only hope, that one day you will die. Mulla Nasruddin went for a world trip. For the first time he was in a ship. And of course he was suffering tremendously, terribly from seasickness. Could not eat a thing, could not drink anything, was continuously vomiting. And then there came the captain and he said to Nasruddin, "Don't be worried. I have been in the service for 20 years. I have never seen or even heard a man dying of seasickness. Don't be worried." And Mulla bent his head. He said, "That was my only hope. I was hoping to die. Nobody has ever died. Your only hope is that one day you will die. So just a little more. Tolerate it a little more. Few more days of the office and few more days of the house. Tolerate. Death is coming to deliver you. That's your only hope. What life is this? Where man hopes that death will deliver. What life is this where people commit suicide? What life is this where people go mad, insane, just because they cannot tolerate it anymore? It becomes too much. It breaks their nerves. No, we are living very unintelligently. And in this unintelligence, enlightenment is not possible. But remember, basically you had come with intelligence. And unintelligence is forced by the society. There is hope. It can be dropped too. It is just dust that has gathered on the mirror. The mirror is still clean and clear. Just the dust has to be removed. Once the dust is removed, the mirror will be as clear as ever. Everybody is a genius. God never creates anything else. God only creates geniuses. Everybody is intelligent. Nobody is mediocre. Cannot be. How somebody can come out of God and be a mediocre? God does not deal in mediocres. He only makes masterpieces. But then the society has force you to become dull. Much dust has gathered on your mirror and you don't look like a mirror at all. What is enlightenment? To attain to your mirror-like quality again. It is a recovery. It is not something that you invent. It is already the case deep down in your heart. You are enlightened. Just on the surface, dust has gathered. You need a good cleansing. That's what we are doing here. A good cleansing. You need a good bath. Meditation is inner bath. Sannyas is a total cleansing. Trying to live intelligently, whatsoever the cost. Trying to live courageously. Trying to live your life in your own way. Trying to do your own thing in your own way. And not bothering what others say. With that declaration, you become intelligent. With the declaration of individuality, you become intelligent. And only through intelligence one day comes the bird of enlightenment. Open the window of intelligence. And wait. The last question. Why are you against marriage? Why should I be against marriage? First, I have never been married. So why should I be against marriage? You need experience for such things. A youngster was thinking about getting married. So he wrote to his father for some personal advice. His father wrote back, I can't tell you how happy I am to hear about your impending marriage. You will find marriage the most wonderful state of bliss and happiness. As I look across the table at your dear mother, I realize with great pride how full and wonderful our years together have been. By all means, get married. You have our blessing. It will be the happiest day of your life. Sincerely, Dad. P.S. Your mother just left the room. Is she single, you idiot? I have no experience, so why I should be against marriage? Unfortunately, my parents were very simple people. They have also not created a sense in me to be against marriage. They have loved each other tremendously, innocently. In my childhood, I have never seen them fighting, quarreling, nagging. They have lived as peacefully as possible. It is very rare to find such a peaceful couple. She watched the young man have his soup with the wrong spoon, grasp the utensils with the wrong fingers, eat the main course with his hands, and pour tea into the saucer and blow on it. Has not watching your mother and dad at the dinner table taught you anything? She asked. Eh, said the boy, never to get married. From my parents, I could not have deduced it. Why should I be against marriage? Those who know, they are against, but then it is too late. Once a friend said to Alfred Adler about a certain Miss X who was going to be married soon. Usually people inquire in such situations, with whom? But Adler asked, against whom? He had suffered much. He knows that a marriage is not with somebody, but against somebody. So it is not right to ask with whom, but against whom. What you call marriage is nothing but an arrangement, a social arrangement. What you call marriage is nothing but an institution. And it is not good to live in an institution. It is not love. It is a poor substitute for love. If marriage arises out of love, it is beautiful. But then it is not really marriage. It is a totally different thing. But if marriage is just a legal binding and there is no love in it, then you are entering in an imprisonment and on your own accord. Marriage as such is going to disappear from the world. It should disappear. Love should be enough cause to be together. I know there is danger, because love is something like breeze. When it comes, it comes. When it goes, it goes. It is not very dependable. It is not an electric fan that you put on the button and sit under it and the fan goes on. Marriage is an electric fan. You can depend on it. Love is a natural breeze. Sometimes it is there, then it is beautiful, but then it is gone too. Any moment it can be gone. Love is like a rose flower. It blooms and withers. Marriage is a plastic flower. It never blooms, it never withers. It is very permanent. Many people have chosen the plastic flower against the rose flower, real flower, because they are afraid of the momentariness. But life is momentary. Life is a flux. To hope in life that one can create something permanent is to hope in vain. You are looking for frustration. The whole life is a continuous movement. Things change. Accept change, everything changes. The only thing permanent is change. So whatsoever is real is changing. That's why fear arises in man's mind. Love cannot be depended on. You have to bring the court in and the law in, so things become permanent. When love disappears, the law will be binding you. But anything that binds is ugly. Unity is one thing. To be tied together is another thing. Mullah Nasruddin and his wife were sitting one night by the fireside. It was a cold night. Mullah was reading his newspaper and the wife was doing some knitting. And the dog and the cat of the family were also resting by the fireside, dreaming, enjoying. The wife suddenly said, "Nasruddin, look at the dog and the cat and how peacefully they live together. Why can't we do that?" Nasruddin said, "Why can't we do that? Tie them together and see." Once two persons are tied together, freedom lasts and anger arises. Freedom lasts and everything becomes ugly. Love means freedom remains intact. Marriage means freedom has been dropped. You have bargained for permanence, for security, and you have paid for it with freedom. Marriage is going to disappear, should disappear. And now the point is coming in the history of humanity where it becomes feasible that marriage can disappear. It is already an outmoded phenomenon. It has lived too much. And it has created nothing but misery. Marriage should disappear and love should flower again. And one should live with insecurity but with freedom. That again I call intelligence. To seek for marriage is to be dull. To seek for love is to be intelligent. Anything that gives you a false sense of security makes you dull, makes you less alert. Anything that keeps the insecurity as it is, life is insecure, love is insecure, everything is insecure, then you remain alert, because every moment you have to be alert. You cannot depend on anything. You cannot go to sleep, you have to keep aware. Then life will have a deeper significance. And life will become more natural. That is the meaning of living the life of Tao. Living it in insecurity is to live the life of Tao. I am not against marriage. I am against the ugly institution that has evolved in the name of marriage. If marriage allows freedom and love to exist together, it's good. But then marriage is totally different. Always be aware. Never lose your freedom and never dominate anybody so that he or she loses her or his freedom. Freedom is the goal. And freedom should be the very foundation of life. Love is beautiful when it flowers in freedom. When it flowers in a hot house, closed from everywhere, it is simply a phony thing. It is not true. And it cannot satisfy you. The flower to be real needs the storm, needs the lightning, the thundering, the clouds, the sun, the wind, needs all the challenges to be real. When you protect it too much, in that very protection, it loses all reality. It becomes pale. It becomes anemic. It is already dead before its death. I am not saying that through love your life will become more secure. No, I am not saying that. Through love your life will become more insecure. But I am all for insecurity. Because through insecurity is growth. When you are secure, you are in your grave. Enough for today.